Hi, everybody. Steve Savitsky, and today we are going to be speaking to Rabbi Josh Spinner, who is the CEO of the Ronald S. Lauder Foundation, and he's based in Berlin, Germany. Rabbi Spinner, how are you today?
I'm very well, thank you, despite the weather in Berlin, which is a bit rainy.
Despite the weather in Berlin. Okay, well, we're really sorry to hear about that. In the recent edition of Jewish Action, in the winter edition 2012, we ran a beautiful article on Torah Judaism is alive in Germany. I've been there, so I know I visited firsthand. Josh, I guess most people are kind of surprised when they hear the vibrancy of the Torah and Jewish world in Germany.
Well, the surprise factor should come in the number of Jews who live today in Germany. That's an unexpected thing for the readership of Jewish Action, that there are 120,000 Jews in Germany today, the majority of whom are immigrants from the former Soviet Union. That is surprising in light of how it is that we, as Jews, and particularly as American Jews, removed from Europe and less familiar with developments there, would expect and understand to see the situation there. But I assume the readership of Jewish Action isn't as surprised by the idea that if there are 120,000 Jews in a country, irrespective of what that country is and what it means to us legitimately, historically, that there would be Torah Judaism there. And so that's a welcome development. Whether the Jews coming there or not, welcome development, was not a question posed to us by the Ribbono Shel Olam. We're kind of stuck with the results. The only question is whether there'll be Torah Judaism there for them or not.
Right. No, there's no question about that. And I think most people don't understand that. Maybe you could elaborate a little bit on how did they all get there? I mean, I know that many of them came from the former Soviet Union, but what was the impetus? I mean, was it the government of Germany welcoming them, giving them, education, housing, and so on? And what was the background to that?
Yeah, well, the background is certainly the fall of the Berlin Wall and the lifting of the Iron Curtain and the possibility of free travel. And so Jews from the former Soviet Union began applying to asking whether it would be possible to visit or come to Germany. And the German government's position was that they're not really in a position, considering the history, to say no to Jews, but rather if there's people who would want to come for whatever reason, that they would welcome them. And so a special law was passed allowing Jewish immigrants from the former Soviet Union to come to Germany and get a very generous package of benefits. And so it became, in the 1990s, it became a viable emigration option. The United States is very limited in who we accept, who gets the green card or family reunification and so on. And the obvious natural location for most Jews from the former Soviet Union who were leaving was Israel. But some chose, for various reasons, staying in Europe, etc., they chose not to go to Israel. And many of those took this opportunity and came between 1990 and around 2005 or so. There was this massive influx that came to Germany.
Now, if I remember correctly, in what was a little different is that while they were welcome, they were sent to different places, so there was never that many in one particular place. Am I right or am I wrong about that?
Yes, but that has nothing to do technically with the Jews. The absorption Germany, like the United States, is a federal political structure, meaning that there is a national government, but there are 16 states, and social welfare benefits are provided by the states. And so the general policy of the German government toward immigrants, irrespective from where, so if they're refugees from the wars in the former Yugoslavia, or our case of the Jews from the former Soviet Union, they are distributed through the 16 states of Germany based on the size of the population and the relative affluence of the state. So a bigger, more populous and wealthier state can absorb more immigrants. And so they were just distributed that way. Then what happens in the state is a comparable process, as housing is provided by cities. So more affluent, bigger cities are better to provide free housing to recipients of welfare, which all of these immigrants are initially. What that all produced for us is a situation in which these tens of thousands of Jews did not initially have the opportunity to gather in big cities, making, therefore, Jewish education and outreach more possible, but instead were spread across hundreds of cities and towns across the country. They're free to move.
I was going to ask you that. So if they want to, they could go to any place they want.
Absolutely. Everybody's free to move, but but you cannot move if you don't have a job. So if you need the social benefits, you need to stay in the place you've been assigned and take your social benefits there. If you get a job, you're free to move. And in fact, that freedom of movement today in Europe is even greater. So anybody who gets a German passport, you know, you can be getting welfare. Once you get a job, you can move anywhere on the continent. You could move to France, or you could move to Italy, or you could even move to the UK.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting. So they lived in different places, and then obviously there wasn't really a lot of Jewish education or vibrancy in the Torah world. And so how did that come about that you got involved? And I guess Ronald Lauder, who was there as the when he was ambassador, that's when I first kind of piqued his interest in what was going on. So how did that whole thing evolve?
Well, yes. I mean, after the war, when I grew up in the States, I had no clue that there was any kind of Jewish community in Germany. It shocked me when I discovered it. I met a young woman who had grown up as a traditional Jew in Hamburg when I was in college, and I couldn't believe that there was such a thing. But there were tiny communities. There were very, very small communities in a few of the mid-sized cities, and there were communities of a few thousand people in the bigger cities, Berlin, Frankfurt, Munich, but these were all dying. These communities were dying. They were not demographically sustainable. And the outlook of the people who lived in these communities, who were the children and grandchildren of survivors, was that the end is coming, and if we can be mechanech our children to get out of this country, then that's what we'll do. Then everything changed when these tens of thousands of people came. And so for the first time, there were numbers. Number one, that needed to be or could be worked with, but also there were numbers of people whose Jewish identity was weak enough that if we didn't work with them, we would lose them. And I think we've lost enough Jews to Germany and in Germany. We don't need to lose more. And so Mr. Lauder was one of the first people to realize this, the need and the opportunity. And so he began exploring the possibility already in the mid-90s of creating educational programs and outreach programs to try and give the children of these immigrants, the former Soviet Union, a chance to learn about Yiddishkeit and become connected. That's how it all started.
Wow, unbelievable. It's really incredible. And then how did you, I mean, people read the article, kind of know, but how did you get involved in it?
Well, I was a typical kind of post-college northeastern United States case. I did spend a year learning in Eretz Yisrael after I was done college, and I was more or less law school bound, but I wanted to do something. With all due respect to the lawyers listening, I wanted to do something meaningful before I became a lawyer. I got in touch with people who were running a wonderful organization at the time called YUSSR, who were running programs in Minsk and Belarus. And I went there for a year, and I ended up staying a second year. And at the end of the second year, I was heading back to the States to go to law school, and I bumped into... that's another way of saying Hashgacha Pratis. I bumped into Ronald Lauder in Warsaw, and he gave me an opportunity, which I could not refuse. And he said, look, you're doing exciting and important things, and why should you just go back to law school and do the same thing as everybody else? Work for me, and let's go do something important for the Jewish people in Europe. That's how I got on board.
And so I guess, when I look at the results, you've really built quite an incredible organization there. So why don't you tell everybody a little bit about what you have? I know there's a Midrash Shah, and then there's a Beis Medrash program. So let's talk a little bit about that and what you've accomplished, because it's incredible, truly incredible.
Thank you. Well, in contradistinction to a lot of other community development projects, we did not begin with a kindergarten or a school. We opened the yeshiva. And we opened a women's seminary called the Midrash Shah, which was originally in Frankfurt and then to Berlin. And what happens if you're running a successful yeshiva and a successful Midrash Shah is that very fine guys meet some very fine girls and they get married. And then we opened a kindergarten. And then we opened a school. And so today, in the last 10 years, what we've done in Berlin is we've created a Torah community. There's about 65 young Shomer Shabbos families who live in it today. And there's about a wedding every month to 6 weeks. And there are also now people moving from other places in Germany and even further afield in Central Europe to be part of this community, which has the kinds of programs that you would find in a normal Torah community. So there's a boys program on Shabbos and a girls program. There's a Kolel Erev for Balabatim. There are Shirim for women. There's all sorts of things that are going on there. And the yeshiva itself has grown. So today the yeshiva has in it 45 bachurim. The midrash has 25 young women in it. Most of these people spend 1 or 2 or 3 years full-time learning as a gap year between high school and university. Then they continue in university or college, except for the select few from the yeshiva who believe and who we believe in, that they have a future in Rabbanus or Chinuch. And to that end, together with Diane Ehrenschroy from London, the former Av Bezdin of the London Bezdin, and now the Av Bezdin of the Conference of European Rabbis for Europe, and the great-grandchildren of Harav Azriel Hildesheimer, we reopened Hildesheimer's Rabbiner Seminar zu Berlin, the legendary rabbinical seminary. And so that exists in Berlin today. There are 8 musmachim, 5 of whom are serving as rabbanim in communities. The other 3 are involved in outreach and education in Germany. And so that, in its own turn, is having a massive kind of multiplication impact across the country. As guys who've grown up in this dynamic Torah community begin to take some of that spirit to other places and launch things there.
And what happens to the ones who, let's say, don't go on to become, rabbanim or mechanchen? They go back to the university, so they spend a graduate high school, spend a year or two learning in the Beis Medrash or the Midrashah for ladies. They go back into the university. So what happens to them?
Okay, so the overwhelming majority of them go to university or college in Berlin, and many, many of them end up staying in Berlin, and they are the core of the families who formed our community. And so there are yarmulke-wearing doctors at Charité. I mean, there are people who you and I and the people listening to this program or the people reading Jewish Action would recognize because they're the people who form our communities in the States. They're doctors or lawyers or people who are in business or teachers or whatever, and they're people who are Kovei Timu Torah, and they come to Shul, and they're living what I would put into big quotation marks when we use the word normal, but they're living normal, balanced, Torah committed, Balabatisha lifestyle.
Uh-huh. And do they all live around the same area so that it's like one community, or are they spread out into different areas?
Yeah, so about a third of the people who come through our program end up in different places in Germany. And when we're happiest when they go to some of the other, communities where there is a daily minion and there is some kosher food, so Cologne, Frankfurt, Munich, these places have all benefited from some of our graduates. But the ones who stay in Berlin all stay in our neighborhood. And so there's one neighborhood. It's in East Berlin, in an area today which kind of culturally, I guess, it's comparable to Greenwich Village. It's a funny place to put a yeshiva community. It's very young and very hip, a lot of galleries, a lot of cafes, and there is a visible Torah community there. You walk on the street on Shabbos and you see people walking around, kids going this way and families going that way and so on. Yes, and we all live in one area of about a 20-minute walk circumference.
And what's the environment? I mean, like, people feel safe wearing a kippah in the streets in Berlin today?
Yes. The general answer to the question is yes, despite the news reports. I mean, we always get the news reports about when things go wrong. Our neighborhood is a very young, very international, and very liberal neighborhood politically. In our neighborhood, I mean, people are just completely used to seeing from Jews walking around. And so in our neighborhood, it's exceedingly rare that anything at all happens. There are other neighborhoods of Berlin, like there are in many urban places, where it's less safe and one needs to be wise, perhaps at night or perhaps here or perhaps there. But generally speaking, in kind of the center of Berlin or in the neighborhood that we live in, there isn't really any problem at all. And it's not at all analogous to the situation in some other Western European countries, like certain areas in France, where there's a lot of tension and even violence on the streets. That's not the case in Berlin.
Mm-hmm. And as far as the yeshiva goes, so now there's a day school, which started in kindergarten, goes through what?
We're up to grade 6, which means next year there'll be a grade 7, and we continue.
And it's co-ed or separate? How does it work?
We have a very interesting consistency because we have some parents who don't even define themselves as Orthodox, but who want a proper chinuch that would be offered by such a school. And we also have kollel families in a yeshiva community. And so we try and hit a balance. And so our school is mixed, and the kodesh is separate from grade 5 on.
I see. Okay, that's good. Rabbi Spinner, I know that a lot about the States, and that one of the things that we deal with in the States is what we call our tuition crisis. What's it like there? I mean, is it expensive to send your child to the yeshiva?
No. The yeshiva is, we have an official fee for the yeshiva, but the overwhelming number of people who come from the yeshiva are not coming from homes that are supportive or willing to spend money on their going to yeshiva yet. These are 17 or 18 or 19-year-old men or women, boys or girls, whose parents allow them to go, but they don't. Most of these parents are themselves immigrants, and they're, you know, on welfare, and so they're unable to do that. So we subsidize very, very heavily in our schools. In the primary school, for example, those are parents who are choosing that experience. The primary school, there is no separation of church and state in Germany. And so one can run a religious school and be eligible for state funding. And so our school is state funded, which covers a very significant amount of the tuition. We still have to cover all sorts of things like the Limude Kodesh teachers and a lot of the extra bonuses that make it attractive from an educational perspective, but we're in a completely different situation in terms of core funding than a comparable school in the States would be.
I see. Okay, so that you're able to get the government to pay for the secular education, and it's your responsibility to pay for the religious component.
Generally speaking, not exactly, but basically that's what it works out to be.
Okay,
yeah.
That's great. Now, so how many children are there in the school? Not in the Beis Medrash, in the school.
So there's 65 children in grades 1 through 6, and there's 50 children in the kindergarten, and there's a waiting list of 30 for the kindergarten, and we're now involved in a capital project to put up a new building to accommodate this explosive growth, and the plan is actually to build for a kindergarten of 120. So
really?
You can run that on. I mean, if we're running a kindergarten of 120, it means that there'll be about 25 kids coming out of that per year going into the school. So
that's really
it's,
great.
It's growing really rapidly.
So, I mean, you could have a really nice size school, you know, in a few years. The school could be several hundred children, which is terrific, which is really, really terrific. And you hope to build a high school, eventually build a high school also.
Yes, we do.
Very interesting. It's really unbelievable, because I'm sure most people don't know that much about it. And still to this day, the Ladder Foundation is the main funder of the program?
The foundation funds about a third of all of these programs. Another third is covered by some of the significant institutional funders of outreach and education around the world. And then about a third is raised, you know, from private individuals, donations that are small to big.
So as CEO of the foundation, your responsibilities are obviously a lot more than just the education and the school. You're responsible for everything, correct?
Yes. I mean, Germany, the way the Ronald Lauder Foundation works is that we're active in 16 countries, and in each country there's a country director. I am also the country director for Germany. And so my responsibilities are for all of the countries and to work with the different country directors on what their programs are and what their needs are, troubleshooting, resource development, strategic planning for all of the countries. And then obviously for Germany, I have to do a lot more. I also do the kind of day-to-day management of the institutions that's necessary from somebody who's specifically responsible for that country.
Mm-hmm. Now, is there a lot of cooperation between the 16 countries and, you know, together? Do they have programs, joint programs?
That's an interesting question. I mean, there's one of the things I think that distinguishes the foundation and that Mr. Lauder is very proud of is that the foundation doesn't have a particular shita or hashkafa. So there are wildly different projects in different countries. One might be secular and one is Orthodox and another one is Chabad, and there's really a different range. So there are professional development pieces that we cooperate regularly on. But we don't attempt to impose kind of a uniform standard, and very often the educational pieces are not entirely compatible. Our only requirement from the foundation's perspective is that the projects be well run and that they be attractive to local people. And so opening a project with a certain viewpoint, which no one locally is interested in, is a failure. Open the project, which may not be the way I see things. As long as people locally are happy with it, that's what Mr. Lauder wants to see.
I got you. Is he very hands-on or not really?
He's very involved. He's very involved. He knows that he cares, and you know, all major decisions are done with him. There is cooperation. I'll just give you an example. Poland is a neighbor of ours to the east, and it's a country where there's a lot of compatibility between what we're doing in Germany and what they're doing there. And so they've run a summer retreat for children and families. It's like a multi-generational camp retreat type program. And so 2 years ago, they asked us if we would send them a Magichir and some Bachrim to create like a Beis Medrash environment in the camp so that people could come in and learn. And so we happily did that. And that's become kind of a staple of their program, is there is like a summer kollel type thing going on, which has transformed their camp because it's given it much more of a Torah drive. And so there are all sorts of positive things like happening across borders. Wherever it's possible, we try and make it happen.
But the largest program is in Germany, I presume, unless I'm wrong.
Yeah, the largest investment of the foundation and the most significant program is in Germany. There's a very, very significant program also in Vienna. in Austria, run by my colleague Rabbi Yaakov Biederman of Chabad, an outstanding business school, which is an opportunity for Jewish students from across Europe to get an American and European accredited business college, but in an environment in which, you know, Yontif and Shabbos are observed and kosher food is served in the dining hall, and there are kind of a lot of extracurricular learning opportunities. And then there's, you know, we're also heavily invested in Moscow. There's a fantastic school there, the Lauteritz Chaim School, run by Rebbe Tzindara Goldschmidt and Rabbi Pinchas Goldschmidt, the chief rabbi there. Budapest is a city which is very much something that we're paying attention to today because of the very difficult political situation there, the rise of the far right and neo-Nazis in Hungary. It's a big issue. We have a very large school there. And so Germany is the biggest, but there are a number of others that are in the same league.
What about kosher food? I mean, is it easy to get kosher food, or is it difficult?
But you're reaching me now sitting in a kosher restaurant. So that's the first part
reaching
of the answer to your
kosher
question.
Restaurant. Okay, that's good.
Yeah. Yeah, no, we have in Berlin, we have kosher bakeries, and there are kosher shops in Berlin and in many of the other cities across Europe where there's a significant from population. Because Europe is Europe and because there are no more customs regulations or borders, very often, you know, shchita, for example, is not done in every place. There is no shchita in Germany. Today, we get our meat from Manchester or from France or from Antwerp. I mean, in American terms, you know, it sounds unusual because it's a different country, but for example, Belgium and Antwerp is a 6-hour drive away. So it would be comparable to somebody, I don't know where, in Columbus getting their meat from Cleveland.
Right, exactly.
Something like that.
Right. I understand that. So, I mean, it's really fantastic what you've done. As I said, I was there many years ago, and I look forward to coming back to see the development. I'm sure it must be absolutely incredible. I'd love to do that. And so the people who are in the listening audience, certainly I would encourage people who are listening, if you really want to see something interesting and a rebirth, Berlin, and what they've done here with the Lauda Foundation, the yeshiva, the day school, the Beis Medrash, the Torah learning, it's really incredible. And really, I mean, it always boils down to one person with the vision and the drive, and you know, there's no question Rabbi Spinner is that person, and so it's a great point. And we, by the way, at the OU, I'm sure people don't know it, we have a very good relationship, and we actually send kids there during the summer, right, to your summer program, right?
Yeah, we have a partnership with NCSY. Our youth program is called Am Echad. Work closely with them, and yes, we do. One of the NCSY summer programs, JOLT, is run now in partnership with us. We do a summer camp together.
Correct. Wonderful. Well, listen, thank you so much for coming on the program. I know that the article was very well received, and I'm sure people now going online will be able to listen to the interview live. So thank you very much, and thank you for coming on the program. Have a wonderful day.
Pleasure. We look forward to seeing you again in Berlin. Steve, it's changed a lot since you were last there.
I look forward to that. Thanks a lot.